pilot area where the pilot was took the brunt of the hit. Certainly the most extensive damage was there.
A plane crash leaves a pilot dead in Ketchikan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 23rd of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Alaska Native corporation teams up with Lockheed Martin to bid on missile defense contracts.
It's going to mean, you know, Alaska jobs and Alaska hires, which we think is key in providing the best value to our customer.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
A 38-year-old Pacific Airways pilot died in a float plane crash this morning in Ketchikan. Federal agencies are investigating the cause of the crash, which killed the plane's only occupant, pilot, and Ketchikan resident Josh Murdoch. From member station KRBD, Deanna Garrison reports.
The De Havilland Beaver was returning to Ketchikan from a round-trip flight to Thorne Bay Friday when it crashed at around 7:30 in the morning. The accident occurred at the site of the former Ketchikan Pulp Company landfill adjacent to the pulp mill property in Ward Cove. Trooper spokesperson Beth Ibsen.
Troopers and North Tongass Volunteer Fire Department, Coast Guard, and officers with Ketchikan Police Department all responded and located the 1959 De Havilland Beaver, owned by Pacific Airways of Ketchikan, crashed on a grassy knoll north of Ketchikan.
Ibsen says Murdoch was found dead upon arrival of emergency personnel. She says one of the plane's wings separated from the aircraft around the time of impact.
Witnesses reported to troopers that they saw the plane clip some trees, and the right wing was actually found close to the plane, but it was definitely knocked off from the plane and it crashed. It was found 50 feet away from the rest of the crash.
The plane was carrying cargo at the time of the crash. North Tongass Fire Chief Dave Hull was amongst the rescue personnel to respond to the scene.
There was no fire. There didn't appear to be a rupture of the belly tank. There was no strong smell of fuel or anything like that. It was a fairly violent end to the flight.
Hull says it appears that the plane crashed nose first at a relatively steep angle.
It is crumpled is probably as good a description as anything. The pilot area where the pilot was took the brunt of the hit. Certainly the most extensive damage was there. The fuselage area from, say, about where the entry door is back was fairly well intact, although both floats, of course, were torn up. And the wing that stayed with the plane was also pretty badly damaged.
Pacific Airways declined to comment for the story, pending a conversation with the deceased pilot's family. The National Weather Service is reporting low visibility and windy conditions at the time of the accident. Tom Ainsworth is the meteorologist in charge with the National Weather Service in Juneau.
Friday morning, a very strong weather front was moving through the southern panhandle, and it had a lot of wind with it and very heavy rain. And so this morning at around 7:30, clouds had lowered to below 1,000 feet and visibilities were as low as around a mile and a half for a while during very heavy rain. And wind speeds at the Ketchikan Airport were reported to be gusting up around 30 knots. So it was a windy, strong weather front that moved through.
The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating the accident. Senior NTSB investigator Clint Johnson says investigators are slated to arrive in Ketchikan on Saturday.
What we'll do is once we're on scene, there'll be an extensive records review. What we'll then do is see if we can get the airplane back to a hangar where we can lay the whole thing out. Obviously going to be interviewing witnesses at length and also talking with the folks from Pacific Airways there to see if we can put together the sequence of events which led up to this accident.
The NTSB is in charge of determining the cause of the accident. Johnson says the on-scene investigation would likely take 2 to 3 days. He says a preliminary report should be out within a week. A final determination of the cause of the accident should be issued within the year. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Aerospace company Lockheed Martin has added an Alaska Native corporation to the team it's building to pursue the contract for maintaining and developing U.S. missile defense systems in Alaska and the lower 48. Lockheed is teaming with Nana Regional Corporation subsidiaries on a $3 billion five-year contract the Army is putting out for bid. Lockheed Martin Vice President of Missile Defense Matt Joyce says Nana, which has had a support contract at the primary U.S. interceptor site at Fort Greely for 7 years, would take on new responsibilities through the missile defense contract.
Two of Nana's companies, Savunik and Akama Logistics Services, will work together with us to provide logistics management, engineering, and supply support services at Fort Greely, Alaska, where the majority of the GMD ground-based interceptors are deployed.
Joyce says the Nana companies will also work at Army Missile Defense System Program offices in Huntsville, Alabama. Many of the missile defense jobs at Fort Greely are high-tech and commonly filled by outside workers, but Joy said that will change with Nana.
It's going to mean, you know, Alaska jobs and Alaska hires, which we think is key in providing the best value to our customer.
Nana subsidiary Akama Logistics President Jonathan Wittes says his company can train Alaskans to fill the positions.
Working with Fairbanks, North Pole, and Delta specifically to do that. We look first for the workforce there, and that doesn't necessarily mean people who already are perfectly suited for a specific job, because we're quite open to helping people get trained to fit the right thing.
Nana is the second partner Lockheed has brought to its missile defense team. The state-owned Alaska Aerospace Development Corporation, which runs the Kodiak Rocket Launch Complex, is also a member of the Lockheed lead group that will bid on the missile defense contract. Lockheed says it expects to announce additional team partners in the near future. The RFP for the Army Missile Defense System is due to be out next month, with a contract awarded early next year. The missile defense contract has been held by Boeing for the last 10 years, and the company will compete to retain it. The legislature continued task force hearings today designed to get more of Alaska students ready for higher education or careers. The group of 20 lawmakers and experts came together with the goal of coming up with recommendations to improve the graduation rate and reduce the number of students who need remedial studies when they get to college. The task force was set up by Senate President Gary Stevens, who is also its chairman. He says the current system is not working.
It's not that we're plowing new ground here. We need to, though, find out exactly what is the cause of so much student dropout along the way, and think about what can we do to help the situation. What can the legislature do? What are your recommendations to help us, help our students, and impact Alaska's economy and the success rate of our young people?
The task force wraps up meetings today. They'll also gather during next year's legislative session before making a full report in April. The Alaska Supreme Court has denied a request for injunction against the Alaska Railroad's herbicide spraying permit, clearing the way for the railroad to begin using chemicals to kill weeds along their track right-of-way. The permit had been challenged by the Alaska Community Action on Toxics and the native village of Aklutna, citing fears about human health impacts, water contamination, and overspray of berry-picking areas. Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Larry Hardig had amended the permit to disallow spraying within 200 feet of any water wells along the right-of-way. The court said the permit will stand as amended. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, fun with bears.
Before we came here, we'd only seen one bear in the distance. So we've been
pretty exciting. I was beginning not to believe in bears, I must say, but now I believe in bears.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Bear Fest kicked off this week, and in Wrangell, you can't talk about bears without mentioning the Annan Bear Observatory. The observatory is one of the Wrangell Ranger District's biggest attractions. KSTK's Tony Gorman went down to the observatory last week and has this story.
After a long trip on a jet boat,
stay in your groups.
A quick rundown of do's and don'ts.
And you'll probably end up intersecting each other, but it's important that you stay together.
And a hike along a boardwalk trail. 19 brave tourists ventured off into the wild, all for the chance to look at bears up close and personal at the Annan Bear Observatory.
There's been quite a few people. Everyone seems to be having a really good time, and everyone's gotten a great show every time they've come.
Angie Aldred is a forestry wilderness technician at Annan. She says ever since the observatory opened earlier this month, no one has left disappointed.
Everyone loves it. There's been bears almost every time. I mean, usually we'll get some brown bears showing up with cubs and a couple black bears with cubs, so everyone seems to love it.
The observatory has been a tourist hotspot for a number of years, and getting a permit can be hard to come by.
Well, we're limited to 60 people a day between July 5th and August 25th.
Dee Galla is the outdoor recreational planner for the Wrangell Ranger District and manages the observatory. She says there hasn't been any significant changes in visitation for the past several years.
July always is busy, and we usually have all the reservations taken. Sometimes people cancel, but yeah, it's busy in July. It kind of tapers off in August.
Galla says the Annan cabin has also been booked for most of the month. With comments from some visitors, it seems like that trend isn't going to change anytime soon. On the day I visited, Annan got visitors from different places, like Colorado.
And I like the fact that getting a count of the bears, too, gives you a little adrenaline going.
Anchorage.
Oh, it's great. Of course, it's beautiful. But just seeing the bears, and as soon as we got here, there were bears. So it's really fun.
Atlanta, Georgia.
Good to be here. So good. My husband really enjoys it. So I don't know if I'm going to have a hard time getting him back to the boat or not. But right now, he's enjoying it so much. He loves the natural environment.
In Sydney, Australia.
Before we came here, we'd only seen one bear in the distance. So we've been
pretty exciting. I was beginning not to believe in bears, I must say, but now I believe in bears.
If you're wondering where's the mighty bear roar in this story, that's because the bears were pretty quiet that day. But that didn't stop them from climbing up trees, crawling from under the observation deck, and fishing for pink salmon in the nearby creek. The black bears seemed to rule the area. Only one brown bear managed to show up, and all it did was catch its lunch, eat, and left the scraps for the bald eagles. Why more black bears than brown bears? Wrangell Ranger District biologist Sarah Bullock explains.
The black bears, they tend to be pretty much all day, pretty steady action throughout the day, but the brown bears usually stay away from the observatory deck, except for a couple of very habituated bears.
Even though brown bears tend to stay out of the public light, there is one in particular that is not shy around visitors.
Her name is Georgie. She's kind of our rambunctious teenager, and she gets really comfortable with people, and she'll come a little too close, I think, for people's comfort.
Forestry technicians have since been more aggressive with Georgie in order to keep her from being a little too comfortable with people. So far, that seems to be working. Reporting from Wrangell, I'm Tony Gorman.
Representative Don Young was one of yesterday's yes votes on extending unemployment benefits. He was one of 31 Republicans to support the bill. All but 10 Democrats voted for it. The final vote was 272 to 152. President Obama signed the extension into law yesterday, right after the House vote. In the Senate, Lisa Murkowski was a no vote. State Fish and Game officials want the courts to delay a ruling which would push subsistence harvesters out of the fall caribou hunt. Earlier this month, a Kenai judge ruled the upcoming August 10th Nelchina caribou hunt illegal because recent changes in the hunt's permitting scheme violate the state constitution. But with more than 800 permits already issued for this year's hunt, game managers say the court decision will only cause suffering. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Last year's Otna community hunt was deemed a success by fish and game officials, although the Alaska Outdoor Council was not pleased by the new hunt permitting regime. The new community hunt allows harvesters in 8 Athabascan villages in the Copper River Basin moose and caribou tickets under a strict set of guidelines. Fish and Game also scrapped the old Tier 2 subsistence hunt, which allowed permits to those with a long history in the hunt no matter where they lived, and replaced it with a Tier 1 hunt good only for area residents. A lawsuit filed against the state and Otna by Kasiloff resident Kenneth Manning claimed his right to hunt the Nelchina herd was violated. The AOC intervened, claiming the community hunt creates two classes of subsistence users. And on July 9th, State Superior Court Judge Carl Bauman ruled the community hunt illegal and declared the Tier 1 permits arbitrary and unreasonable. That ruling threw the Nelchina caribou hunt into question. Fish and Game had already issued 850 permits for the community hunt this year. Bruce Dale is Region 4 Supervisor for Fish and Game's Department of Wildlife Conservation.
Following the court decision, both the Tier 1 hunt and the Community Harvest Program hunts were enjoined. So as of right now, we legally cannot hold those hunts.
Dale says Fish and Game has asked for a temporary stay of the court's decision so that area hunters can be provided an opportunity for a caribou harvest.
The season was supposed to start for caribou August 10th and run through September 20th, but there's no way we can legally provide hunting opportunity in that short a time frame. So we asked the court for a temporary stay so we could work with the parties involved in the lawsuit and come up with some kind of hunting opportunity for August and September.
Dale says if the court does not grant the request, area hunters will have to wait until the winter hunt starts in October to get their game under the Tier 2 regime.
We're hoping that they'll act quickly, and I think there's indication that they understand the situation.
Ken Johns, president and CEO of Otna, the regional native corporation in Copper Center, could not be reached today. Johns has said he's disappointed in the judge's ruling. Otna asked for the community hunt and administered it last year. The new community system helped many younger hunters get permits. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska senators say they want to see the details of top Senate Democrat Harry Reid's plans for a scaled-back energy bill. Yesterday, Reid abandoned the effort to get climate change legislation passed this summer. That frustrated environmentalists and disappointed liberal Democrats who want to see pollution from the nation's power plants curbed. Reid says instead he'll unveil next week the details of a much smaller bill focused on responding to the BP oil blowout in the Gulf of Mexico and tackling some minor energy issues. Senator Begich says he needs to see more of what Reid has in store. Begich says he wants to see how it's paid for and find out what the oil spill legislation entails. Begich says he won't support it if it curbs oil and gas exploration in Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski's spokesman on the Energy Committee, Robert Dillon, says Reid is including the committee's bill that deals with the BP oil spill and reforms the Interior Department, but that may not be enough to win Murkowski's support. Dillon says Murkowski wants to see her work last year on an energy bill advanced. That includes pushing renewables and controversial elements like nuclear power and offshore drilling.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Operating a forklift is serious business, and operators are required to be properly trained and certified. The emotional and financial damage can be severe when a family member never comes home from work or comes home with a debilitating injury due to a forklift accident. Training information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Scientists in Southeast Alaska's Tongass National Forest are trying to find ways to save an economically and ecologically valuable tree, the Alaskan yellow cedar. Some of the latest experiments are focusing on whether cedars can be transplanted further north, along with a search for the hardier genetic strains of the tree. KFSK's Malati Kay has more.
That's lot number 213. Lot number 196. Yeah, there's six. We were growing 16.
Forest Service Silviculture's Artie Parks is standing in the Ocean Beauty Cookhouse cold storage in Petersburg, looking at boxes filled not with fish, but yellow cedar saplings. The cold storage serves as temporary housing for the saplings to keep them dormant or slow their growth. Later, they'll be sent north to Juneau, where the different strains will be tested for their genetic resistance to deer browsing and freezing injury.
What they're doing is they're planting them all in a similar area so they can see which ones do better at different elevations.
The study springs from a 100-year-old mystery. Anyone who's been out on the water in Southeast or flown over the region in an aeroplane has probably looked over at the surrounding mountains and seen clumps of dead yellow cedar trees. Forest Service biologist Paul Hennin says these increasingly common white patches of dead snags are one visible indication that the region's climate is changing. Hennin is testing whether cedars might survive if he just replanted them further north.
We're just checking survival, just curious to see kind of what the survival rate will be, how many will still be alive, and if there are any animals that may be feeding on them.
Hennin has planted study plots near Yakutat, where the cedars are present but not abundant, once found throughout the Tongass. Alaskan yellow cedar has been on a steady century-long decline. The species is one of the state's most economically valuable timber sources because of its resistance to rot. Also, yellow cedar is culturally important to Alaska natives, and Hennin hypothesizes that cedars, dead or alive, may increase calcium and nitrogen levels in the soil. When he started studying the tree die-off, Hennin thought it was due to a root rot disease. His 30 years of research on the species suggested to him that it was more an issue of climate. Yellow cedar evolved during the last ice age, when regional temperatures were cooler and the cold season was longer.
We've done a lot of survey work that shows that yellow cedars are dying on these wet soils at low elevation and kind of the areas that have warmer winters in Southeast Alaska. If we go to higher elevations or colder areas, especially up towards Prince William Sound, the cedars are fine. They seem to be healthy there.
The Alaska Climate Research Center found that over the past 60 years, Alaska has seen a mean temperature increase of 3 degrees Fahrenheit. Mean wintertime temperatures around Southeast have warmed by 3 to 6 degrees, so Hennin is trying to see if cedars might do better further north or at higher altitudes. Hennin is also observing how forests near Sitka and Ketchikan are changing, given the dying cedar trees. In Petersburg, I'm Melody Kay.
Tucked away on a remote section of coastline on Seldovia Bay, a small group of local kids are getting hands-on with the natural world and learning about the plants, animals, and geography around them while having a lot of fun in the process. KBBI's Aaron Selbig spent a day with the kids and has this story.
You can hear waterfall in the distance. So across the bay, there's some waterfalls.
SVT Prevention Program Coordinator Laurel Hiltz leads me into the camp, which is headquartered about 5 miles out of town on a magnificent bayside vista at the Sea Otter Lodge at Harmony Point. Stopping to point out 3 roped-off square plots of land near the lodge, Hiltz says the theme of this year's camp is archaeology.
The kids are going to come and actually work through the different levels, and they'll have borrowed artifacts that will be at different layers representing different periods of time. So obviously the top layers being the most recent and then working their way down.
As I join the group on the very first day of camp, it becomes quickly apparent that Culture Camp is not your typical summer camp with a heavily regimented itinerary of activities to keep the kids focused. Although it does have a loose itinerary, Culture Camp is way more laid back. Kids here are free to explore the natural world, free to play spontaneously, and free to make games up on the spot. During a long morning hike up to the headwaters of Seldovia Bay, in a bayside patch of tall grass, taller than a few of the small kids, the group decides on an impromptu game of hide-and-seek.
Okay, who hides?
While Richard, the only boy in a group of 7 campers, volunteers to hide, everyone else counts to 30.
27, 28, 29, 30! Ready or not, here we come!
Richard and Carmen are brother and sister. Their family splits its time between Anchorage in the winter and Seldovia in the summer. 7-year-old Carmen says she's been to Culture Camp several times, but she always learns new things.
Well, last time I learned this red type of rock is If you crunch it up and add water, it makes paint.
Richard is the only boy at culture camp this year, but he doesn't seem to mind.
Nah, it happens all the time.
Really?
Yeah, gives me more people to bug.
Bug all the girls?
Yeah.
Okay.
These are little handheld ones, and this is what people...
Richard gets his turn to lead some of the girls after lunch when camp counselor Tracy sends the campers out in groups of three on a GPS treasure hunt. After a quick lesson on the ins and outs of handheld GPS units, the groups are given a laminated card with grid coordinates on it and are instructed to follow them to a series of three checkpoints. At each checkpoint, the group will get a clue to their final destination, which is the location of a mystery prize. And with that, Richard, Mariah, and Tia are off.
Is it up here?
Yep.
We're going in the right direction.
It doesn't take long for the kids to get turned around.
Really? Let me read the card. Let me see the card right now. Right now. Yeah, I see inside a plant.
Okay.
That
inside a plant whose needles can be used to make tea.
After a few fits and starts, the kids begin to figure things out.
Do it. That way is north because Homer is that way.
Yeah.
And we're in the south area.
Okay. Yeah, so we need to go
west.
West.
She said
that
way. Wait. Never eat sour waffle. No, it's this way.
No, it's this
never
way. Never
eat soggy waffles.
It takes a while, but the group eventually finds the Holy Grail, a metal cash box hidden in the base of a rotting tree stump.
What's the treasure?
Hershey's bar.
Hershey's milk chocolate.
I'm going to be exact.
I'm going to have some.
Later in the evening, the culture campers will hear some storytelling from local native elders, and then they'll take off on an evening nature hike focusing on Aleutic plant uses. The next day, it's time for some lessons in archaeology with visiting staff members from the Pratt Museum in Homer. Reporting from culture camp in Seldovia, and sorry to have to leave, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of our stories tonight, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Wrangell, Melody Kay in Petersburg, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Aaron Selbig in Seldovia. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Alaska's Institute of Technology Maritime Department is offering a Coast Guard-approved Marine Oiler class beginning September 13th in Seward. The course will familiarize students with propulsion, power generation, and auxiliary systems on motor and steam ships. Required prerequisite training criteria is on the web at avtec.edu. Information at 800-478-5389. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.